Hello and welcome to Nonviolent Direct Action, where we examine the societal and personal ramifications of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s insight that to passively accept an unjust system is to cooperate with that system, and thereby to become a participant in its evil. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of Episode 5 in the series, entitled Disarm Trident, Peace Walk, Part 2. Today I'll be speaking with three more participants in the walk, which started on September 4, 2018 in Savannah, Georgia. They are Steve Baggerly, Beth Brockman, and Bill Offenlock. The Disarm Trident Peace Walk is in solidarity with the recent Kings Bay Plowshares action and was originally scheduled to end on September 14th in Kings Bay, Georgia. However, due to the approach of Hurricane Florence, it ended on September 12th. Reading from the Kings Bay Plowshares 7 website, seven Catholic Plowshares activists entered Kings Bay Naval Submarine Base in St. Mary's, Georgia on April 4, 2018. They went to make real the prophet Isaiah's command to beat swords into plowshares. The seven chose to act on the 50th anniversary of the assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who devoted his life to addressing what he called the triple evils of militarism, racism, and materialism. Carrying hammers and baby bottles of their own blood, the seven attempted to convert weapons of mass destruction. They hoped to call attention to the ways in which nuclear weapons kill every day by their mere existence and maintenance. Kings Bay Naval Base opened in 1979 as the Navy's Atlantic Ocean Trident Port. It is the largest nuclear submarine base in the world. There are six ballistic missile subs and two guided missile subs based at Kings Bay. And now my conversation with Steve Baggerly. So I looked on Facebook earlier. Yours was the one of the three names for tonight that I was actually able to find some information on.
Okay.
And I saw that you were involved in an action at an air show. Is that correct? Where you stood on top of a large airplane with anti-war banners?
That was me. And actually, Beth Brockman was part of that, too.
Okay. And was that in conjunction with Catholic Worker?
Yes. Yep, and the SLC, the Southern Life Community.
I had not heard of that group. I'm planning to download that picture and put it on the blog post because it is really quite a visual.
Great.
So tell me how you got involved with this particular action or peace work in general.
My wife and I met in college, and we joined the Catholic Worker movement right out of college. We went to the LA Worker in 1987. We were arrested for the first time that November, along with my wife Kim Williams and I, and Phil Runkel, who's the Catholic Worker archivist. All of us were arrested blocking the entrance to the Nevada test site, and it was the first arrest for all of us. And that was kind of the beginning of our life of crime.
Well, they say the family that gets arrested together stays together.
That's true. We've been together a while.
Well, good for you.
Thanks.
That's great.
My wife just got arrested for occupying an excavator that was putting in a natural gas pipeline 100 feet from an elementary school last month. That's been part of the rhythm of our life for all this time. We're with the Catholic Worker community. We started the Catholic Worker community in Norfolk, Virginia in 1989. And so we've been at it for 32 years almost. And, you know, working with homeless folks, feeding people, sheltering people, and then also connecting that to militarism and nuclear war. And, you know, so much of poverty and suffering on the planet is connected to our vast expenditures and our willingness to destroy everything through nuclear weapons. And so it's always been, working against war and nukes have always been part of the rhythm of our life.
I think we need a lot more people like you in this world. And I just have to wonder, how did you escape the matrix, so to speak? The system does everything to make people like you conform and believe their propaganda. But on some people, it just doesn't work, apparently.
Yeah, I mean, I guess for me, I was always skeptical of stuff coming down from above. Humanly speaking, from authorities, and while I was in college, I went to That was the first place I did Catholic worker type work was in North Philadelphia with a community of Franciscans. And they did anti-war work as well, and as part of their charism, and they really ruined me for life. So they were the folks that, you know, inspired me to go towards the Catholic worker ultimately. Yeah.
And what year was that?
That was 86. And so, and actually literally, you know, just the thing that also really did, it was just getting to know poor people, and especially getting to know poor African-American people, and realizing our common humanity and the common humanity of all people, you know, 7 billion people. And we really do all share one nature, you know, we're all really part of each other. And I guess coming to that realization, I mean, at least for me, so then it's like, well, as long as people are hungry and homeless, what else am I going to do besides try to help feed people and shelter people? And as long as all of the human family and every child on the planet is targeted for extermination by these weapons, you know, how can I not be involved in that?
Right. I think the system wants us to objectify each other and to not have those feelings, those common humanity type feelings for each other.
Exactly. And so I also hear it as a gospel call as well. You know, I hear Jesus, that this is what he's all about. You know, he's about, like Cornel West says, justice is what love looks like in public. So the whole thing is how do we receive God's love and how do we pass it on? You know, and this love that is just overarching and cosmic, and how do we tap into that in our personal life, and then how do we live that in the world? I mean, that's what it's really all about. And so meeting people like the Franciscans and folks in the Catholic worker movement, I mean, we really, you know, took those as, you know, signs of a direction our life could take. And my wife and I, we've been doing it ever since.
That's wonderful. Is this your first day of the march?
I came on the second day. I missed the beginning in that walk out of the center of Savannah.
On the 4th.
Yeah, on the 4th. Picked it up on the 5th. We were, you know, just getting out of the city and heading into the countryside. But I've been, so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, so 6 days.
Has it been 10 to 12 miles a day since the first day? I know the first day was
it has.
6 miles a day, or 6 miles that day.
Right. It's been 12 miles since.
I think I would like to hear more about your background.
So we're in Norfolk, Virginia. After our 2 years at the Los Angeles Catholic Worker, we started the community in Norfolk, Virginia, the Catholic Worker, and we named our house Sadako Sasaki House of Hospitality after the legendary girl in the Peace Crane story who died from atom bomb disease after, you know, a few years after the bomb was dropped in her hometown of Hiroshima.
Those were paper cranes that people made all over the world, right? Could you refresh my memory and so people who don't know what that's about?
Sure. Sadako Sasaki was 3 years old when the bomb was dropped on Hiroshima. When she turned 12, she got leukemia, atom bomb disease. And in Japanese culture, you fold 1,000 cranes and your wish comes true. So she's wishing for her healing, but she dies before folding 600 cranes. And then her classmates finish folding the 1,000 cranes for her, and they're wishing for world peace. And so in Norfolk, that time in the late, in 87, when we moved there, there were, you know, the delivery systems for nuclear weapons, their submarines, and even, you know, aircraft on aircraft carriers carried nuclear gravity bombs, and there was enough nuclear delivery systems there to destroy much of the world. So we thought that Sadako would be a very appropriate person to name our house after.
I would say.
We were very affected by a couple of three-year-old girls at the LA Worker when we lived there, one from Nicaragua who had a radically cleft palate, and another one from Mexico who had cancer from drinking, you know, chemical-laden water in Tijuana, and Kim and I were both there when she died from her cancer, and she was 3 years old. So we had these three-year-old girls on our hearts when we moved to Norfolk, and we just, and between all the machinery of war there, we thought Sadako would be the right person to name our community after.
And where did those chemicals come from in the water? Maybe I missed that.
In Tijuana, you know, all the maquiladoras
right.
along the border,
industrial
all these factories,
waste.
Industrial waste. Yeah. And so since we've been there, Norfolk's got to be the most militarized place in the Western Hemisphere. Norfolk Navy Base is the largest Navy base in the world. There are a dozen other major bases within 5 or 10 miles of Norfolk. And so we've, you know, anti-war work, vigils, civil disobedience, writing, speaking against war, has been part of what we've done the whole time we've been there. And that also includes, you know, we've gone other places to do actions as well, joining friends, and I participated in the Plowshares action myself in 1997 in Bath, Maine, at Bath Iron Works. We hammered and poured blood on an Aegis-guided missile destroyer. For a number of years, we regularly met and did actions. That was like Catholic workers in North Carolina and Virginia. And we would have retreats once or twice a year. And so the action on the B-52, we've done a couple of air show actions and a couple of actions in North Carolina over the years as well.
And the B-52 is the plane that you stood on top of at the air show that I was referring to earlier?
Right. That's at Oceana Naval Air Station in Virginia Beach.
It looked like you were getting quite a bit of attention that day. There was a huge crowd of people in uniforms gathered around looking at you standing on top of the B-52, you and two or three others.
Yeah, I guess I don't even know who those cadet-looking folks were, but they were young people in uniform, so something was going on. But yeah, those air shows are the, you know, their biggest recruiting tool. And the technology is awesome, right? I mean, that's where all our money and our creativity go, into the latest bombers and fighters. And you know, these air shows are all over the country, and hundreds of thousands of people go, and getting ready, you know, recruiting our young people, so that, because we're at war forever, so we're recruiting the next generation of children to fight our wars into the future, into the foreseeable future. But nuclear weapons have always been a central concern, and so this Plowshares action happening down here in St. Mary's at Kings Bay is really powerful, and we are so grateful for these folks doing that. And I came in July. There were five of us or so that fasted here. We'd fasted for a week down here and had a vigil at the base and the courthouse and the jail. And so I was here for a week then, and then Kathy Kelly was, during that fast, people started planning for this walk, and it's been great, you know, the experts at the Bulletin for the Atomic Scientists say that we're 2 minutes from midnight. You know, in January, they moved their doomsday clock. It's the closest we've been to midnight since World War II. You know, things are that serious.
I think we're at the most dangerous moment in human history.
Wow.
I don't know if you've been following the news the last several days while you've been out on this walk, but the tensions in Syria have really ratcheted up, and it's between the U.S. and Russia, because the Syrians and Russians are apparently trying to take out the, let's call it terrorist or al-Qaeda enclave in Idlib, and
right.
The U.S. wants to protect that because that's their last stronghold in Syria, which the United States has no reason being in, no right to be there in the first place.
Okay. Yep.
And so we're looking at a scenario where U.S. and Russian forces could be in armed combat with each other very shortly. They may already be, but we don't know it.
Wow. That's not to mention the Ukraine and NATO,
right.
You know, NATO exercises and Russian exercises on the borders, and the stuff with, you know, Russian bombers flying up to our airspace, which we've done to their airspace forever. But
right. I think a few weeks ago, one of the NATO planes accidentally let loose a missile, which, I don't know if it made it into Russian territory, but it wouldn't take too many incidents like that to really start something.
Yep. Yeah, and so the U.S. and Russia have 90% of all the nuclear weapons, and really it's our, you know, these two, the two great powers, we really need to get together and... So there's a treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons now. You know, there's an excellent treaty. It prohibits the development, the manufacture, the deploying, the use, the threat of use of nuclear weapons, and it gives reparation to people who lives have been devastated by nuclear testing over the decades, and calls for, you know, renewing the land that's been destroyed by this testing. And so it's a great treaty, and none of the nuclear powers attended the negotiating of the treaties, but the U.S. and Russia really need to get their act together, especially, I mean, I think if the U.S. does something that other countries, it would be interesting to see what other countries would do, because so often, you know, other countries are reacting to what we do.
Who has signed this treaty?
The treaty was adopted by 122 countries last July, but then you sign it and you ratify it. 40 countries have signed, 14 have ratified. Once there's 50 ratifications, it goes into effect. But even if it's all countries that don't have nuclear weapons, not the 9 nuclear weapon states, it still starts affecting those nuclear weapon states because, you know, businesses that are, like in the U.S., there are 28 corporations that have some part in making nuclear weapons. And so the countries that have ratified the treaty are going to, you know, be divesting themselves from these corporations. Countries that have ratified the treaty, like New Zealand did it last month, it's going to be harder for the U.S. to transfer and transport nukes. I mean, other countries don't do that, but we move our nukes around the country, around the world into NATO countries, and it'll be harder to transport through, you know, other ports or airspace or on land at other, you know, go through other countries transporting our stuff. So that's some ways that it'll start tightening things on the nuclear weapons countries a bit, as well as, you know, really stigmatizing and reworking the framework of talking about nuclear weapons and just talking about them and their humanitarian consequences as being immoral, rather than the main talking points about nuclear weapons being that they're a security, they're necessary for security. It'll reframe, hopefully, the global conversation on it to say, no, they're really immoral and they need to be done away with, you know, just like cluster munitions, landmines, biological weapons, chemical weapons. Before them, they'll be outlawed internationally. So, I mean, that's a spark of light on a pretty dreary landscape. And so that's one thing we're pushing for in Norfolk, too, now, is we're really trying to, because this treaty is around, and the Pope, the Vatican, was ratified it on the first day. And so the Catholic Church has gone from saying it's okay to have deterrence, to have nuclear weapons for a deterrence, and the Catholic Church has said, no, the time for deterrence is over. Time for disarmament is now. The Pope has condemned both the possession and the threat of use of nuclear weapons. He's condemned their existence. He's condemned deterrence. But in the United States, even though all this stuff is going on, it's like there's complete silence. You know, the politicians don't talk about the treaty. The media doesn't talk about it. The Catholic Church doesn't talk about it. So that's one thing we're taking up right now at the Catholic Workers, trying to spread knowledge about this treaty, because it is a practical step that really could be the framework for a complete disarmament for the foreseeable future. But the group that kind of worked on it and made it come to fruition is ICAN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, and they won the Nobel Peace Prize last year. The two people who accepted the Nobel Peace Prize for ICAN were Beatrice Finn, who's a Swedish woman who's the president, and then Setsuko Thurlow, who was a Hiroshima survivor. And if people haven't heard their acceptance speeches, they're on YouTube, they're on the Nobel Peace Prize website, and they're fantastic.
Go maybe listen I'll to link them. To those also on the blog
that would
be post great.
Super.
On nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com.
Great.
I guess maybe one final topic would be, what do you hope to accomplish from this? I think in a way you've already answered that with your interest in this, getting this treaty passed. But more specifically with the walk itself, I know you're publicizing the recent Kings Bay Plowshares 7 action. Could you talk a little bit about that, and maybe how this walk ties in with that action?
I mean, really, literally, this stuff is not talked about. you know, in this country. I mean, I guess we're getting closer and closer to King's Bay, where obviously that's what everybody's bread and butter, and what they practice every day is the end of the world on these submarines. But it's really like a well-kept secret, you know, that we're at 2 minutes to midnight, and things are really in a crisis mode, and it's like nobody cares, nobody knows about it. And so to just raise awareness, raise the issue of nuclear weapons and the need to get rid of them, just to be that no on the landscape, I think is really important. Just to raise the issue, just to get the word out there, wave to people, talk to some people that are walking by, just to be out there and spreading the word as best we can as we walk through the state here, and to be that no on the landscape, because our landscape is dead silent on it. So the combination of action and spreading the word.
And the action that this walk grew out of is the Kings Bay Plowshares action at the Trident Naval Base, where 7 activists, some say illegally, some say moral necessity, they entered the base and poured their blood, and they waited to be arrested, and now they're facing serious charges. So this walk is in solidarity with that other previous action, which occurred in April of this year, 2018.
So yeah, in support of the Plowshares, the 7 Plowshares folks, and spreading the word about their action as well, and showing support for them as we walk down the coast.
You're listening to episode 5 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is entitled Disarm Trident Peace Walk Part 2. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of this episode, and we just heard from peace activist Steve Baggerly. Next is my conversation with Beth Brockman.
So I'm a little different from this little trio here in that I came to activism quite late in my life. And it was in 2003, and I was in my 40s, and a friend crossed the line at the School of the Americas down in Columbus, Georgia. And this was something completely new for me. We had been pen pals for many years, and when I found out that he was in jail after that action, and I felt really called to visit him. And so I drove down to Columbus, Georgia to visit my friend in jail, having no idea that there was such a thing as a prisoner of conscience, at least here in the United States. I'd heard of it in other places. And so I happened to go visit him at the same time that the trial was happening down in Columbus. And so I met all the activists that were gathered there, folks that had crossed the line and were preparing for trial, as well as families and, you know, family and friends of those folks. And it really opened my eyes to resistance as a means of expressing one's faith. And I feel like it was in that moment that my eyes were opened to another way of being, another way of expressing my faith, and was not only exposed to the world of resistance, but also to the Catholic Worker. And spent a lot of time with Catholic workers and folks that were involved in resistance, and that would include Steve Baggerly. And the Southern Life community was my main group that I kind of hung around with, and did a lot of support and did a lot of for actions people were doing. And it wasn't until 2005 that I took my first arrest, and it was at Oak Ridge on the 60th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. And yeah, have been living a life of crime since then.
We need more lifetime criminals such as you in this world. Do you have any observations on the walk so far? For instance, how has it been going over with the locals?
We were walking, you know, against traffic and a lot of traffic coming into Savannah for work. And there were just a lot of waves and honks of support, much more than honks of or signs of disapproval. Of course, there's some. And then great support in Savannah from the church that was hosting us, and media showed up for the send-off that we had from the park. It was pouring with rain, and we're surprised that they showed up, but they did. And then for me, I get to walk into kind of convenience stores, and we stopped at a produce stand, and so there's opportunities to talk to people. And mostly, I have found support towards the action, more so than our walk and why we're walking walking for disarmament. So my experience has been more support, but I also know that we are getting closer to Brunswick. In fact, we'll be walking in Brunswick tomorrow and down towards the base and towards St. Mary's. And I've been down here quite a few times doing jail support for the folks that were first in Camden County and then in the Glynn County Detention Center. And it's a much different environment in those locations.
In what way?
Like, for example, there's a pastor here in Brunswick who's very supportive of the action to the point of providing hospitality for the group of us that came here to fast, but he cannot speak about it to his congregation, and I know that from his congregation he's got a lot of flack for supporting the action and the plowshare activists. And I heard that also from a pastor down in St. Mary's, the same sort of thing. And folks that do come out, well, and also have come out to support but won't vigil with us outside the base. In fact, there's one local supporter down in St. Mary's who, because she did vigil in years past, she worked on the base at the time, and she lost her job. It's just
hurts.
I know. It's just a really militarized area. And it's hard to get past that when the base at Kings Bay provides so much employment, and then there's a Trident refit that employs a lot of people too. I don't know a lot of information about what it actually does. I only remember seeing posters down in St. Mary's that said, you know, come to the base to this Trident refit, and they would, it's like a job training kind of program that they provide a stipend for. So, yeah, and we've heard from the locals down in St. Mary's that this is the main source of employment. There's not much else down there.
Well, there's an old saying that it's hard to make someone understand a concept when their paycheck depends on them not understanding it.
Right.
You mentioned going into stores and talking to people. Were you somehow identifiable as connected with this action when you went into those stores?
The walk, you mean? The disarmament walk?
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I have a support van, and I'm buying bags of ice to put in coolers, and then, you know, they see the folks walking, or they've heard that we're coming. They've driven by. So, yeah. Yeah, it's...
You didn't have signage or like a t-shirt, anti-war t-shirt or something?
No, no. I look pretty benign. I think it's just a guilt by association.
I see. What are your goals in taking part in this walk?
I've been very interested in the last 6 months to a year in what it looks like to invest in community and divest from systems of oppression, such as the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex, and how do we divest from those kinds of systems? And this walk seems like an investment in community, people coming together to, you know, walk in solidarity with an action that took place at Kings Bay Base to disarm the weapons there. And the commitment of everyone seems like a good investment of my time, a good investment for community building, a good investment in continuing the witness, a good investment in building support for the action and for disarmament. Yeah, it just seems the place to be.
I wish I could be there.
Yeah, it's a great place. I mean, I've been very taken by this landscape. I love it. It is stunningly beautiful here. and it's mysterious and eerie and beautiful, and what lies on the surface is just on the surface. There's so much below the surface. It's a mystery, and I like the heat. It agrees with me. And I live in North Carolina, so it's not like I'm too far away, but there is something very, very different about the landscape here.
And where is here? I don't think we ever said that.
We didn't say that. I mean, the South District of Georgia, Brunswick.
Okay.
Brunswick, St. Mary's is where I've spent most of my time, because it's where the jails are located, and my primary involvement has been doing jail support for the action that took place in April. I think I might echo what, you know, Steve said earlier about this being a real kind of act of faith. And for me, I'm also a spiritual director, and I'm interested in people's stories and the stories that we tell through our actions. And I'm thinking that, you know, the story kind of began before this walk even began, and to kind of continue in, you know, walking in faith, and continue to listen to one another's stories seems to me the greatest way to kind of build community. And I really do believe that community is kind of the ultimate resistance to empire.
Well, I think the empire wants everyone to be fragmented and hating each other.
Yes.
So community sounds like the antidote to that kind of fragmentation and hate.
Yes.
And
yes.
And we certainly see an abundance of hate in the world these days.
Yeah, and I mean, you can even see it, you know, when Mark came out of jail, he was talking about the experience there, and he felt like, you know, it was a pressure cooker. And actually Liz McAllister, one of the seven, called from the jail today to talk to us. And I said that to her, and she said, it doesn't have to be that way. And of course I agree, but they create these situations in which they don't provide outside activity for the prisoners inside. They don't provide them, you know, with adequate enough exercise or sunlight or healthy food, access to healthy food. And so you create the situation in which people begin to fight and there's a lot of conflict. And, you know, Mark spoke about it pretty sternly. And then the situation in Georgia is even exacerbated by the fact that folks go to jail and don't have bond hearings for weeks.
And Mark is one of the PowShare 7, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mark Koval. Yeah, so he's one of the seven defendants that recently got out. And, and that's what he was talking about, that, you know, his experience on the cell block, and it's been my experience in what I've heard is happening in, you know, throughout Georgia, is that people are being held for long periods of time, for weeks, before they even have a bond hearing. And then once bond is placed, the bonds are high and poor people can't afford to get out. But even with that, Mark was saying, and I think this is true, you know, even with all of that, and community still forms, you know. Mark talked so positively about the men on his cell block. All the defendants have talked really positively about the people who they were locked up with. And so community, you know, forms despite the system trying to squash it and to fragment us.
Were those inmates aware of the ongoing nationwide prisoner strike?
I asked Mark that, and he said no. Knew about it only because someone was talking on the phone with him about it. And that strike actually ended today, the anniversary of the uprising of Attica. So, yeah. So it started on the August 21st and ended on September 9th.
You're listening to episode 5 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is entitled Disarm Trident, Peace Walk, Part 2. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of this episode, and we just heard from peace activist Beth Brockman. Next is my conversation with Bill Offenloch.
Well, it was really the Vietnam War that forced me to make some decisions. I was in the college seminary and decided that I wanted to be a conscientious objector to make a statement against the war.
What year was this?
I would have graduated in 71.
Okay.
So I did leave the college seminary and applied for my CO status and really never got it. They delayed it a year with paperwork and then decided that my lottery number was too high, that they weren't going to call me. So they didn't want to have to deal with it. So they kind of just put me in a holding category where they would never have to deal with it. And since I had struggled preparing my own claim, I decided to be a draft counselor to help other people deal with their draft situations, the people that were unfortunate to have lower lottery numbers. And I did that for 2 years for the Catholic Peace Fellowship, which was kind of an offshoot of the Catholic Worker in New York. It was sort of a more activist peace group specifically aimed toward conscientious objectors.
Society then was, I think, deeply polarized and very politicized. I started college in 1971, so I was kind of, we almost overlapped there.
Yeah, but with the draft, it affected people personally. They couldn't ignore it.
Right.
So you kind of had to make a choice.
Well, you know, and I think the flip side of that was that when they ended the draft, a lot of the activism calmed down, and I think that was to our shame.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that it takes that kind of personal kind of fear to make people think about things and question the war. But after that, I ended up kind of working for the Catholic Peace Fellowship, doing general peace work, and one of those things was about disarmament. And there was a strong movement in the early 80s for what was called the nuclear freeze.
I remember that.
Yeah. And there was a really, I'd say it was a huge movement at that point. But
there was a group called Sane Freeze, right?
Yeah, they later combined. But mm-hmm. The Freeze was originally an independent group that, as it was fading away, then Sane kind of combined with it. But those were the days that you had a million people come to Central Park calling for nuclear disarmament in 1982.
Really took off.
And we thought the movement was building, but it kind of fizzled out. It's a lot of different opinions why it didn't go further. And in the Catholic Church, too, in 83, the U.S. bishops made a fairly strong statement against nuclear weapons, saying they only possess them for deterrence. And that definitely didn't seem to be U.S. policy at that time or now.
No, it's more like a first strike posture.
Yeah, the U.S. is very much threatening anybody and everybody with their superiority in nuclear weapons. And the bishops haven't really said much since then. They make statements, but it doesn't get out into the parishes. And it's a problem right now, too, that the popes make very strong statements, well, Pope Francis particularly now, against even the possession of nuclear weapons as being immoral. But it doesn't get translated out to the people in the pews. And I would say the majority of Catholics in the United States, at least, don't really think about nuclear weapons and don't think it's a major issue, that it's just something hidden away that they don't think is ever going to be used. but the reality seems to be quite different. And I think that's why, like, the Plowshares group go to places like Kings Bay to try to raise the immediacy of this danger. And some people think it doesn't do any good, but we kind of live in hope that something will break through.
Raise awareness.
And create change. Yeah, and here in Georgia, it's only just beginning, really, I think. They had an active group at the base 20 years ago, but that faded away as people aged out and kind of, I think, just gave up.
Going back to the Vietnam War days again, I remember they had active GI organizations, people, you know, active members of the army and military who were against the war and were organizing on the actual bases. So
yeah,
it's
different
today.
And that was a real factor, I think, in causing the United States to pull out of Vietnam. They couldn't rely on the troops any longer.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of fragging where people would kill their officers if they thought they were risking their life needlessly. And
not at all uncommon.
Most of the people were doing drugs and kind of just unable to really fight.
And a lot of heroin.
Yeah, and it was the army discipline like completely broke down because it was seen as a unpopular, unjust war. But the government seems to have corrected that, though, now with the all-volunteer military. And they're avoiding a lot of those problems.
And, of course, they only have a volunteer army because the other opportunities are so non-existent that that's all that remains for a lot of people.
Yeah, it's really an economic draft now.
That's right.
Rather than a political draft. And the individual soldiers end up paying the price that they have kind of astronomical suicide rates after they get out and huge numbers with PTSD and
PTSD.
People just can't deal with life.
I think I'm no expert on this at all, but I think people after their tour of duty is over and they're civilians once again, they start to deprogram and they start to think differently about some of the things they did when they were in, some of the atrocities, and they have a hard time accepting that they did that and living with themselves.
Yeah, there's studies now on what they call moral injury, that they've done things they feel are immoral and it really hurts their conscience. And it's very hard to get over that and kind of make some sort of reparation. So it tends to build up inside your head and really drive you crazy.
We've talked a little bit about how you became involved with this, with activism in general, but how did you become involved with this particular action and what do you hope to accomplish by it?
Well, I've never done a Plowshares action myself. I've been arrested many times, but for things we wouldn't really get more than a week in jail or so. But I'm pretty good friends with many of the actors in this group and kind of want to support them in whatever way I can to make this an effective action. There's a lot of detail work that has to be done with the trial coming up and all the logistics and doing support. When the trial does take place, there'll be a lot of people coming here to show support.
Maybe. And when is that?
We don't have a date yet. Probably in December.
Of 2018?
Yeah. They're still dealing with pretrial motions. An interesting aspect of this case is that they're bringing up the religious freedom. Maybe it is Religious Freedom Recovery Act. It has been used by very conservative groups like Hobby Lobby to say that they don't have to support abortion or support contraception because of their religious beliefs. But
support it with their taxes, you mean?
Yeah. Or, okay. And there was a case of the bakers that wouldn't bake a cake for a gay wedding because of their religious beliefs, and that was upheld. But in this case, they're going to try to argue that their Catholic faith compels them to get rid of nuclear weapons and to sort of try to disarm them. I don't think it's going to really fly, but it's a novel defense that's being brought up, and the court is asking for more information about it.
Well, I think in the case of the baker who wouldn't bake the wedding cake for the gay couple, I think that their position was in agreement with the overall position of the patriarchal society that we live in, and I think that's why they got what they wanted. And on the other hand, peace activists who contend that their religion compels them to do plowshares actions, in other words, to illegally enter military bases and cause damage, that does not flow with the power structure. So I wouldn't put too much faith in that, no pun intended, but I wouldn't expect that to go really anywhere. I mean, it's nice to hear that expressed.
Because the usual problem is the defendants want to raise international law issues and talk about treaties that outlaw nuclear weapons.
Which, again, is a valid point, but probably will not go anywhere.
But the courts have never allowed that as a legitimate. Well, the prosecution asks for what's called an in limine motion, saying that they're going to limit discussion to try to focus on the facts of this case and not get distracted with a lot of politics.
Which, in effect, limits the rights of the defendants.
Yeah, and it has come up like as what's called a necessity defense,
right,
is often invoked and very seldom accepted, where you can kind of go into a burning house.
I think there was one climate case recently where that actually was accepted.
Yeah,
I don't know whatever became of that.
It's going to trial. It's called the valve turners case, where people shut off the pipeline, and the courts.
I saw something on Facebook the other day where one of those valve turners, all the charges were dropped against him.
Oh, I don't know why, I'm not really up to date on that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But one of their main arguments with the religious freedom case is that the law says that the government is supposed to use the least restrictive method to ensure like public safety without in infringing on your religious beliefs. So they're going to argue that government could do a lot of things besides charging them with two major felonies, like each carrying a 5-year sentence. They could have much lighter charges or a way of keeping them out of the base without this super heavy punishment. But we'll see what happens. If we don't have great confidence that this is going to fly.
No, especially in this political climate, which is moving steadily to the right, at least among the people supposedly in charge. I don't know that the whole country is moving to the right, but I know that the power structure, the powers that be, seem to be moving steadily to the right.
Well, it just seems to be getting crazy in Washington.
Isn't it?
I don't know where it's going to end, but at least we're hoping to raise more concern about nuclear weapons. There was a bit of concern when North Korea was threatening to bomb Hawaii, and then they had that false alarm in Hawaii.
Right.
But it seems to have blown over. I haven't seen any real follow-up to that.
I was talking with Steve Baggerly earlier about the situation in Syria, where it appears that the U.S. and Russia are setting the stage for an armed clash. The Syrians and Russians are attempting to wipe out the last Al-Qaeda, or let's be generous and call it rebel enclave in Idlib.
In Aleppo?
Idlib, in the northeast of Syria, and the United States is saying, don't do it. Anyway, yeah, the United States appears at least to be talking as if it's not going to back down. And of course, the United States has no right to be in that area anyway.
And I have real questions as who's making decisions, too, for the United States.
Well, I think that's one of the issues, and you're probably familiar with veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity, and they put out a statement, an open letter to Trump, and one of the concerns that they expressed was that it appears that the Russians don't have a good understanding of who's really setting policy in Washington. And, you know, in a situation like that, where you have nuclear-armed powers in a standoff with each other, that just seems very dangerous to me. Exceedingly dangerous.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's gonna happen. Although with the last cruise missile strike, where Syria supposedly used chemical weapons, apparently they warned the Russians far enough ahead of time that they could evacuate their bases. And it was kind of more of a political gesture.
Well, I think there is a long-standing agreement, which is we're going to try to de-escalate. Both sides are going to try to de-escalate or to avoid situations which could escalate. And I, for one, don't believe there was a chemical attack by Assad against his own people. I think that was what you would call a false flag. That was to give the United States a plausible, I don't think it was plausible at all, but a plausible excuse to do what it wanted to do anyway.
Yeah, I know. No, Ray McGovern has talked about it and feels that the Syrians really weren't behind it, or the Syrian government wasn't behind it.
Right.
But it's almost impossible nowadays to know who's telling the truth. Everybody is saying so many opposite things.
Well, let's put it this way. If it was Assad, I don't think he's that stupid. You know, that was the one thing he could have done that would have ruined things for him, and supposedly he did it. So I don't believe it just on that basis. And I don't think he's a bloodthirsty tyrant. I mean, he's not my favorite guy either, but he's nothing like what we hear in corporate media. You know, he has huge, broad support among the Syrian people. I firmly believe that. But I think we're getting off the subject here, and we probably should wrap it up soon. But is there anything else you want to say about your involvement with the Disarm Trident Peace Walk or Plowshares in general, or your background as a peace activist?
Well, I've just arrived in Georgia today, so I haven't actually done any walking, just been following it on the social media and all. But it seems like it is a good way to try to reach out and let people know what's going on. Like, there hasn't been a lot of media coverage locally, but that in Savannah there was some TV coverage, but hopefully we'll get a little more. We're in the city of Brunswick tomorrow, so they'll see a lot of people and hopefully raise a little media attention. But Brunswick is where the court is, and it's 60 miles or so from where the base is, so they're not as involved, depending on it for jobs and livelihoods.
And so, which court are you referring to?
In Brunswick, the federal court. It's the Southern District of Georgia.
And that's where the trial of the Plowshare 7 will be? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's about 60 miles from the base. But there is no federal court closer. Like, this is the biggest city in Southern Georgia. So the trial will be here.
Are you planning to attend that trial?
Yes, we think it'll be in December, but we don't really know yet. And in past Plowshares actions, there's been a big support community that comes around for a trial with 100 people at least, sometimes 200 that come down.
Mm-hmm.
It will probably be a week-long trial, so I don't know how many people can come for the whole week. But we're now trying to plan logistics to be able to take care of that many people. And they do what's called a Festival of Hope, where you bring in experts on nuclear weapons that wouldn't be allowed to testify in court to sort of at least testify to the public as to the sort of why these things are so immoral and so dangerous.
So they do speaking engagements? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, around the trial, several nights they have like public meetings to try to reach out to the local community and the media,
mm-hmm,
to kind of explain why people are doing this.
Yeah. In local churches?
Yeah, there's some support in the churches, but the individual pastors are a little nervous about being too public about their support, because it will be very controversial. And the climate in Georgia is not too sympathetic to nuclear protesters.
Right.
So I hope that their moral kind of convictions are able to win some people over. Whether they agree with them or not, they can respect them for taking this great risk to try to save the world.
You've been listening to episode 5 of Nonviolent Direct Action, which is entitled Disarm Trident Peace Walk, Part 2. I'm Wilton Vaught, host of this episode, and we just heard from peace activist Bill Offenloch. We heard previously from Steve Baggerly and Beth Brockman. You can find this episode and the entire Nonviolent Direct Action series on iTunes. You can find related links on our blog, nonviolentdirectaction.blogspot.com. Thanks for listening.